before we start on the science fiction, I'm going to do a little profile about you. So, will you tell me a little bit about yourself? I know you were raised in Kentucky. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
I was raised rather traumatically in Kentucky. I was born in San Francisco. And when I was a kid, I was put into a hospital in San Francisco while my family moved to Kentucky. And after a year and a half in the hospital, when I was 10 years old, I got out and went from a rather genteel, upper-middle-class life in San Francisco into a really Appalachian environment in a fairly tough part of Lexington, Kentucky.
Why were you in the hospital?
I had rheumatic heart, children's heart disease. Or at least so they told me. I don't have any evidence of it now when I got checked. Anyway, being immersed into Kentucky all of a sudden was really a shock to me. I think that's what I was writing about in a deep way when I wrote The Man Who Fell to Earth. My spaceman comes from another planet to rural Kentucky, where he is shocked by his entrance into that culture. As it turned out, after a few years, I fell in love with Kentucky, and I feel very good about Kentucky now. But for a while, it was a considerable shock. And I think that experience threw me into being a kind of lonely, scared kid, and I did a lot of reading, and I trace my literariness to that part of my life. I wasn't allowed to do sports because of the heart disease. And I spent a lot of my time sitting in a chair reading books until I got old enough to go to the pool room. And then that changed my life in another way. I suppose I grew up, I learned how to swear and how to swagger in the pool room. And it sort of replaced for me that part in my boy's life that is taken care of for other boys by playing football, basketball, whatever. Anyway, those two things, I suppose, had an enormous formation on me, part of my formation, the getting interested in books and getting interested in pool at roughly the same time in my life.
Where were you educated?
Oh, in a lot of different places, but I got a bachelor's degree and a master's degree from the University of Kentucky, and then I did a second master's at the University of Iowa and did PhD work there, too, although I never took a degree.
The Iowa influence, I would imagine that was a key point in your life, at least in terms of becoming a writer, is that correct?
Well, actually, I had published my first novel, The Hustler, before I went to Iowa. I went to Iowa to do not a creative writing degree, but a standard literature degree, but I wanted to go there because there were a lot of writers around, and they were more sympathetic to writers. So I think I was pretty well formed as a writer by the time I went there, although it's very hard to trace your influences, you know. I like to say that I've been strongly influenced by Ernest Hemingway and William Faulkner, but the fact may be that reading all those books with titles like Don Sturdy in Africa when I was 13 had more of an influence on me than I would like to know.
Was there any deliberate intent on your part to become a writer, or did you fall into it? How did it evolve?
I always was pretty skillful at putting sentences together. And I can't remember the first time that a school teacher told me that my writing was so good that I ought to try to be a writer. But I always had an elementary glibness with pen and paper, and knew that I could do that sort of thing better than most people. But didn't really consider making a profession out of it until I graduated from college and became a high school teacher in Kentucky and found myself in kind of a economic deadlock, making a minuscule salary for a lot of work I loved, but realizing after a few years of it that I was caught in a trap. I'd be going bonkers doing that the rest of my life unless I found a way out. And I thought I would try writing, so I wrote short stories and was able to sell them to magazines. And after a few years, I would get as much money for one short story as my annual salary was as a high school teacher. So for years and years, I wavered between teaching and writing. And it was only 6 years ago that I quit my job as a professor of English at Ohio University. I'd gotten to be a professor by that time, in order to move to New York and write full time. I've been in New York now 6 years, and I've written 6 books. My aim is to write a book a year for the rest of my life.
At one point in your life, weren't you a full-time gambler? Didn't you tell me that the last time you were here?
I tried to make my living gambling briefly, but I couldn't call myself a full-time gambler, no. I was an obsessive gambler. I gambled all the time, but I did not keep records, but I doubt that I really was able to support myself that way. I'd like to be able to. I think that's probably what I told you. I used to dream of it, and I'm sure that had a lot to do with The Hustler. It probably has a lot to do with The Queen's Gambit, which is about a person who makes her living playing chess.
You did all right. You really hit it big with that first book.
Possibly bigger than I could handle, yeah.
What year was that?
The novel came out in 1959, and the movie came out in 61.
Did you have anything to do with the screenplay?
I worked on it along with two other people. And it was based pretty much on the dialogue in the book. It was one of those movies that's an almost completely faithful adaptation of the novel. But I didn't actually block out the screenplay, no. I've written a sequel to The Hustler and have just finished doing the screenplay for 20th Century Fox. I hope there will be a film next year, if all goes well.
You've also gotten into science fiction in kind of a different way than most science fiction writers. But how did that happen? First you deal with the gambler and the hustler, and then all of a sudden you...
I think that began with me reading The Wizard of Oz and The Emerald City of Oz. I like imagined worlds. I like made-up worlds. That has attracted me to science fiction. I've despaired of reading a lot of science fiction. I'm tired of science fiction that deals with battles between good and evil, with imitation medieval romance or whatever. I think, say, Star Wars, which has its fascination, is a kind of imitation medieval romance with black knights and white knights and boys coming to manhood. I'm not interested in writing those stories. But I am interested in the background. I'm interested in the imagined world that underlies the story. And I've attempted in my own writing to create my own science fiction worlds, but to use a different kind of foreground from the Star Wars kind of thing. For instance, in my current novel, The Steps of the Sun, my hero is a middle-aged real estate tycoon going through midlife crisis. He does not in any way resemble Luke Skywalker or any of the characters of that sort of science fiction. I don't mean to badmouth that kind of thing, but I'd like to distinguish what I do from the kind of science fiction that involves sword fighting or what have you.
Well, in fact, when I talked to you on the phone, you said you had written a science fiction novel. And yet, a previous collection of short stories has a subtitle, in effect, speculative fiction, which is not really the same thing, is it?
No, it isn't. The term speculative fiction is used by editors in a desperate attempt to let the public know that this is not Star Wars or Buck Rogers or whatever. Unfortunately, science fiction is a very big term. We don't have in our critical vocabulary a term to describe exactly what it is I do. I'm not trying to say I'm unique. I think other people have worked somewhat in similar genres. But I like to play games with time and space. I like to imagine what the world might be 100 years from now, that sort of thing. But I am not interested in writing about menaces, the giant cockroach eats New York or something like that, which is what some people think of when they think of science fiction. I'm not interested in writing about nuclear catastrophe, devastation, interplanetary war, and that sort of thing. So in an attempt to find some way of describing what I do, editors come up with terms like speculative fiction.
In The Steps of the Sun, you write about the United States, the world in about 2060 in that area,
That's
as
right.
I recall. The fuel sources are virtually depleted, and the hero of your book sets out to find new fuel sources. Tell me, give me a nutshell. Tell me what the book is about a little bit and how you feel about it.
Well, it's meant to be a kind of comic psychological novel at heart. It is character-centered. Its main character, Benjamin Belson, is a middle-aged real estate tycoon. He's a multimillionaire. He is suffering from sexual impotence. He has just recently undergone a painful divorce. He is bored with making money. He finds life in New York, a city which he loves very much, more and more dispiriting as New York loses its vitality and bounce. It has quaint old-world charm. It is kept going largely by a great influx of money from Chinese tourists who come here for the music and the restaurants, China being the wealthiest nation on earth by the time this novel is taking place. Since the United States is very limited in its fuel supplies, it won't use nuclear fission ever since the Denver incident, when apparently Denver had been devastated by a meltdown. And consequently, the elevators don't run in the big buildings. New York is a dying city. My hero, Belson, in despair at this, and in despair with his own sexual problems, his own psychological problems, buys a mothballed Chinese spaceship, sets forth on an exploration trip trying to find a form of safe uranium, a uranium that can be used for nuclear fission but cannot melt down, on other planets. It's been imagined that uranium formed under different gravities from that of Earth might produce an isotope that would be safe in energy plants.
Is that really true?
It's possible. I talked to a couple of nuclear physicists about it. It's within the realm of possibility that there would be a way of fissioning uranium that would, if the uranium were constructed a little differently from our Earth sources, it would be safe. Anyway, it served my purpose in my novel. He does make that discovery, and he is able eventually to repower New York. The book ends with the relighting of New York, or the relighting of Manhattan, in a scene that I like very much. But what happens more importantly for me is that he undergoes a spiritual awakening on another planet. When he isolates himself on that planet, it becomes its only inhabitant for a period of 5 months. And it's there that he really is able to come back to himself, to gain a kind of strength that he had found missing in himself. This to me was very important. It was something I wanted to write. It was something that I felt was happening to me or had happened to me, a kind of sense of spiritual change. But I didn't want to be heavy-handed about it. I wanted to be light and easy about it. And I found the science fiction framework ideally suited for my purposes. And I also found the comic tone that I hope I achieved in the novel the proper way of conveying that kind of thing. For myself, I feel that the most important things in life are best conveyed in a comic way. So I meant this to be a serial comic novel.
I think the reader, although there are spaceships and other planets, will find it quite different from what he might expect from a science fiction story. You are a very sexy writer. You have a lot of sex, language that you would not normally associate with science fiction at all. You deal with the character's impotence, for example. Apparently, you feel there is a distinct place for one's sexual orientation in such novels.
The way my life was at the time, I too went through a bout of impotence, fortunately temporary, that happened just before I started this novel. I found myself at the age of 50 undergoing even more outrageous transformations in my psyche than I had when I was a teenager. I found myself victimized by gusts of emotion on windy nights, that sort of thing. I was falling in love, having all of these things. Fortunately, that didn't last terribly long either, but I was impressed at, I was amused by this when it wasn't too painful to be amused, and it was something I wanted to write about. I feel this happens with a lot of us in midlife, we undergo these things.
I'm also amused by you're transplanting Midwesterners into a New York City environment, not probably much different from your own relationship with New York. Let's go back a bit. You were teaching at Ohio University, and something had to happen in your life to trigger a desire to become completely independent and take a shot at full-time writing. How did this come about?
Well, it was a lot of things, but the most dramatic single one is this. I'm a recovered alcoholic. And I was a quiet drinker. I never went to a classroom drunk, but I would quietly souse myself almost every night in my armchair at home, fall in bed, and pass out. It was all very quiet and the sort of thing that nobody mentioned publicly, but it was getting really bad. My novel, The Man Who Fell to Earth, is about falling into alcoholism. It was written at a time when this was beginning to happen to me. I wrote that novel back in 1961. Anyway, in 1975, I sobered up.
Just sobered up?
Well, I put myself into a very good alcoholic treatment center in Columbus, Ohio, where I got the word and stopped drinking. I was sober when I went in there, but I was really feeling wretched. Anyway, they helped me through that, and I haven't had a drink since. And after a couple of years of sobriety, I began to wake up in a lot of ways, and I realized that I was going to have to make some serious changes in my life if I didn't want to fall back into that milieu, that psychological milieu that had led me to drink. And I felt it was very important for me to commit myself to my career as a writer, which I had been avoiding during the years that I'd been drinking. I had had a rather easy early success as a writer, and then apparently had avoided the consequences of that success by drinking. And now that I was sober again, I decided to continue that career where I left it off. And to do that, I felt it was necessary to come to New York. I really wanted to make a commitment. Mm-hmm. So I started a novel, Mockingbird it was called, which is a novel about sobering up. It may not appear to be that, but it's essentially that. It's a science fiction novel about the far future in which everyone is drugged all the time, and the main character stops taking drugs, learns how to read, becomes the only man alive who knows how to read in that high technology future, and whose mind and soul begin to undergo changes because of this breath of wind blowing through his spirit, with his with his senses no longer numbed with drugs. And a similar thing was happening to me. Anyway, I started that novel, was able to get a substantial advance from a New York publisher, enough money to allow me to quit my job and to come to New York and rent a small apartment and start writing full time.
Which is what you're doing now.
Which is why I was able to move into a larger apartment. The books have done well, and has worked.
Do you work at home?
Yes, I do.
Do you have, what kind of workspace do you have?
Oh, I live in the bottom of a townhouse, and I have a beautiful room with a bay window overlooking the street with taxis whizzing by. I love all that. And that's where I work every morning.
What kind of discipline do you have for yourself as you write?
Well, I don't... I'm not a Nazi about it. I'm perfectly willing to take it a day off whenever I feel like it, but I try to get to my typewriter by 9 o'clock in the morning, and I try to stay there until 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And sometimes I stay there until dark, and sometimes I don't.
Tom Keneally has a terrible problem. He's an Australian writer. He lives on the beach. Unfortunately for him, he lives at the nudist end of the beach, so he had to grow a very high hedge. his workshop looked over the beach, and it was very distracting. Well, my last question, what themes will you be exploring in the future?
Oh, I really don't know. I think that every writer tends to write the same book over and over again, and part of the trick and the skill consists in disguising that fact from everybody, including yourself, I suppose. But I am beginning to fear repeating myself. I think I need to find some new themes. I tend to write about alienated persons. Now, admittedly, a New York real estate man is quite different from a professional pool hustler, who is quite different from a man from Mars, who is quite different from a girl who plays chess for a living. But to me, they're all alike in that they're isolated individuals who are doing something that the mainstream doesn't fully comprehend or sympathize with very much. And that does seem to be the thing I keep getting attracted to, persons of that kind. I suppose it comes out of my childhood, my own feeling of estrangement, possibly out of living in Kentucky when I was actually a San Franciscan. Anyway, I think I would like to get away from that a little bit, but I'm not really certain. I'm between books right now, and it's a choice I'm going to have to make in the next few weeks.
What do you do when you're between books?
Sleep late and talk a lot.
And no booze.
And no booze, no. Well, I hope I got enough said about the steps of the sun.
A couple of things that I liked, nice little touches about the future. Macy's, for example, being used as a cold storage bin.
That's right. Bloomingdale's is a bus station. It's a lot of fun, and there are no more trees in Central Park. They've all been chopped down by wood thieves. That kind of thing in science fiction I enjoy immensely. Sometimes I have to rein in my imagination because I don't want to clutter up the book, but I did very much enjoy things like crowding the streets of New York with Chinese tourists, changing the look and feel of things, inventing that game set that my hero was given by his aunt in New York, that where he can play snakes and ladders, Monopoly, checkers, chess, in French, English, or in any other language. This kind of technology is an awful lot of fun to do.
Don't forget the John Glenn Hotel.
Oh, that's right, the John Glenn Hotel in Columbus, Ohio. That's right, that's right. And the Reagan Stir, the Reagan Detention Center in Washington. Mm. That's right. And Kissinger Air Force Base, too. I didn't want to load up too many, 1980s references in the book. That would seem a little bit out of place. But it's fun to do. And there's a statue in Washington of Guadalupe Mendoza, the first woman Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, whom my hero has always admired because he had her picture on a bubblegum card when he was little. Right. That kind of hardware, I guess you call it, for science fiction attracts me enormously. And it's a lot of fun to drop those things in subordinate clauses, as it were, as part of the background of the novel. Now, I've just finished doing two realistic novels, The Queen's Gambit, the one about the chess player, and The Color of Money, a forthcoming novel, which is a sequel to The Hustler, about Fast Eddie and Minnesota Fats 20 years later.
When's it coming out?
Comes out in August, Warner Books. And I've sold movie rights to 20th Century Fox, and I hope there'll be a movie starring Paul Newman.
Yeah.
We've talked about it.
20 years later? 30 years later?
23 years later.
23 years later?
Yeah, right. Fast Eddie gets back to pool playing again after years away from
it. Wasn't Jackie Gleason?
Jackie Gleason and Paul Newman, right.
Get him back, Jackie.
Well, I don't know if Jackie Gleason will be in this film. I talked with Paul Newman. He and I had dinner together about 6 weeks ago, and he's very much interested in making the film, although he hasn't committed himself to signing a contract yet by any means. He hasn't read the screenplay yet.
Right.
But who will play the other parts, I don't know. And whether Newman will play it, I don't know. He certainly seemed enthusiastic, however. And Fox, as I say, has signed a contract with me for it. Anyway, that's another realistic novel. It takes, it's sort of a hard-boiled, Hemingway-ish novel, I guess. I like it a lot. I put a lot into it. But having done two novels in a row in which people smoke Marlboros and drive Buicks and turn on the Sonys and they inhabit the real world that we all know and are slightly bored with, it would be fun, I think, to do another fantasy novel, another speculative fiction novel in which I can invent my world. You know, when I invent a future, as I did in The Steps of the Sun, which takes place around in the 2060s, I'm not interested in predicting the future. I don't know what the future is going to be like, and I'm not arrogant enough to pretend to be a futurologist, most of which I think, futurology, I think is largely nonsense anyway, extrapolating from Kurtz. But, so I don't know what the future will be like, but I like to invent my own version of the future for the fun, for the play.
Science fiction is that it often does not hold up well over the years, because often too many things come to pass that make it out of date.
Sure.
Science fiction can become quaint. Some of the things Arthur Conan Doyle wrote, like The Lost World, Jules Verne.
Sure.
But many of the science fiction stories of the 30s and 40s and 50s.
Well, of course, 1984 is the great case in point, considering our current year. I think
that has more sociological...
It does. Impact. I think the thing to say about 1984 is what I would like to say about my own science fiction. It is that 1984, I think, is really about what 1948 felt like to George Orwell when looked at in the worst possible way. I think that's essentially what the best science fiction comes from. It's a kind of mythological and symbolical restatement of our own times. When I wrote Mockingbird, which is about a very grim future in the 25th century, I'm really writing about a certain grimness that I see in our own lives today, and the grimness that I've seen in my life. For me, you know, that's what the vehicle of fantasy is really for, is to say something in that way, which human beings have been saying for years and years, that particular form of exaggerated fairy tale storytelling, to say something profound about our own lives. So The Steps of the Sun is not really an attempt to discover what the world's going to be like in 2060. It's about a certain dispirited sense of American capitalism as I see it today.
Yeah, it's about us today.
It's supposed to be a grown-up book. It's the kind of science fiction that I wish people would be writing, and I think some other people do, too. But it's meant to be...
A tempestuous relationship, I think, in the second story.
Yes, there is. Well, that of course doesn't in itself make a thing grown up, but I am appalled with the fact that so much of science fiction does have a kind of adolescent feel to it, which was very exciting when I was an adolescent. I was tremendously immersed in those things, but when I look at it from my present age, it seems sophomoric and like. And I don't mean to badmouth all science fiction writers. Some of them are wonderful, but a great deal of it has concerns that are highly mechanical and don't touch me in any particularly human way. That is a mechanical creation of the hardware of the future of space travel or what have you. I really want to see a kind of grown-up science fiction dealing with real people and real circumstances, but with improbable backgrounds. This is what I like. This is what I like about ancient mythology. It's what I like about fairy tales. It's what I like about medieval romance. I like it when you have an extravagantly imagined world peopled by real beings. And this is what I essentially aim at.